Please listen carefully.
The act of taking a thought from my head and putting it into your head.
Communication to me is everything. It's the strongest way for two people to convey information to each other.
Bridging what I have in my head to the outside world.
Open conversation with another person.
I think it's the ability to share your innermost feelings and thoughts with others.
Communication is the way that people interact with others, no matter what modality it may be.
Welcome to episode number 3 of the SpeechScience.org podcast. I'm Matt Hott, alongside, as always, Chandru Vital down in Texas.
Hi, everyone.
Ivan Campos out on the far west coast in California.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
And Lucas Stuber coming live from an art gallery tonight.
Yes, I'm in Vancouver, Washington. It's actually a party full of audiologists, of all things. So I'm hiding outside.
So they can't hear you very well, can they?
The audiologists?
I think they left their hearing aids at home.
They're all in there. Yeah, every time I walk in there, I hear things about auditory processing. So I'm just going to stay out here.
Gentlemen, this is a special week. We're recording it on the 5th or 6th of May, depending on what part of the country you're in. Cinco de Mayo, Star Wars Day, May the 4th. Fun days in speech and language therapy.
Yeah, it's a big day. It's a big month.
Definitely. Better Speech and Hearing Month also.
Yes, the ASHA Better Hearing and Speech Month, BHSM, with the hashtag. Check that out on Twitter. Gentlemen, how has your weeks been?
My week's pretty good. I've just been working on the Insandia final projects. I was doing a lot of research for my final project, which is a proposed study on bilingual code switching for people with aphasia. I think it's really interesting. I could talk for like hours on this, but I'm not. I'm just going to say it's really interesting stuff. And if you ever want to learn more about it, call me.
That's great. I've had a really good week myself. I do want to call attention really quick to some activism that ASHA is involved with. And if you're engaged with our Facebook page, we did share some of their materials. Not to get political, you know, we stay out of it, but just check it out. There's some healthcare changes coming that might be worth advocating for our profession for. Other than that, though, it's been a good week for me. I set up there's a video also on our Facebook of setting up an eye gaze system for a young lady with Rett that's never had one before, and it was pretty adorable. She's got her four little female siblings all standing around her cheering, and that was very rewarding. You know, it's one of those examples of when you come home and are real happy with what you do for a living.
Ivan, how was your week this week?
You know, it's been a very interesting week. I guess the highlight of my week so far has been one of the patients that I'm working with at the pediatric rehab facility is probably about 2 months post a traumatic brain injury. I've been working with her for, I would say, almost a month now, and she finally began to vocalize and speak. So it was so amazing just to have her say hello, hi, no, yes, and go away. So that's pretty much, that was the highlight of my week. So,
hey, go away is an important thing to be able to say.
Yes, most definitely.
I've just started recently giving some of my kids the option, because there's only a week and a half left of school down where I'm at, the option to not come to therapy if they don't want to and if they can verbalize it. And I had one kid, first words he said all year was, and he's a selective mute, he said, I don't want to go. And I went, hey, those are words, and I will just observe in your classroom.
Yep.
I agree.
Selective mutism often is just sitting next to him and, you know, being cool for a while.
My therapy week's been pretty lackadaisical. I got a kid to start to use the head switch to make selections on a scanning device. But outside awesome. Of therapy, it's free comic book day on Saturday. So when this airs, it'll be 3 days ago. And also going to have seen, hopefully, Guardians of the Galaxy by the time this airs.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Got to keep up the nerdy speech therapy side.
Yeah, my wife's not going to agree to that one. I might have to go by myself.
Gentlemen, it sounded like we had a pretty interesting week for the four of us. I pulled up a couple articles. I want to hear your guys' opinion on it. And also, I like to hear the listener's opinion. So if you have one, give us an email over at contact@speechscience.org. You can also leave us a voicemail at 503-345-6740, or you can hit us up on Twitter @speech_science. And Ivan, I think, can you interact through Instagram?
Yes, I can actually receive messages through there, and it's the same handle. It's speech_science on Instagram as well.
Perfect. Reach out to us. Tell us what you think. Tell us your opinions on this, or if you have any questions. The first article I pulled, it's from the American Academy of Pediatrics. It hit on May the 4th. The big title says, handheld screen time linked with speech delays in young children. The summary reads, as the number of smartphones, tablets, electronic games, and other handheld screens in the U.S. homes continues to grow, some children begin using these devices before beginning to talk. New research suggests these children may be at higher risk for speech delays. Are any of us really surprised by this?
Not really, to be honest.
I've got some strong opinions about that. I mean, I have to read the article. I mean, you brought it up. I'm going to, you know, email you after this and check it out. But that's like saying that, you know, learning how to sit in a chair, for example, is going to cause a speech delay. You know, we have a ton of research in augmentative and alternative communication, for example, that says that there is not a speech delay caused by using ASC. This is also true, you know, overwhelmingly true of simultaneous bilinguals, right? Mm-hmm. That it does not delay the acquisition of one language to also be acquiring another. You know, we're in this interesting situation now where the ubiquity of touch devices is such that, you know, children are often exposed to them very early. But my argument, I guess, anecdotally, without having read the research, is that my suspicion is that it depends on what exactly they are accessing on those devices. Because there are apps like, you know, even Minecraft, for example, that are not very language rich in what they're being exposed to. But there are other apps that are, you know, educational or, you know, simply language rich that might actually enhance their growth of language. So that's the data point that I think I would need. You know, there's a big movement, you know, here in Portland, Oregon, particularly against screen time. And that can be problematic because then when I have a student that's 5 or 6 or older, you know, then they're not familiar with the conventions of a touchscreen device. And I need them to know that in order to be able to use one effectively.
And to give a little bit of a thing, they looked at 900 kids. They gave each kid about a 30-minute increase in handheld screen time and found 49% had an increased expressive speech delay, but there was no link or correlation between screen time and other communication delays such as social interaction, body language, or gestures, at least according to Dr. Catherine Birkin, the study's principal investigator.
Okay. Did they specify what exactly they were doing on these screens?
No, it says based on a screening tool for language delay, the children by their 18-month checkup, 20% of the children had daily average handheld device of about 28 minutes.
Okay. And see, for me, the gesture and posture piece, I mean, that is communication. That's the foundation is in place.
Exactly.
But again, anecdotally, have not read the research. I will read it, and if I'm very wrong, I will correct myself in our next podcast.
Well, and that kind of goes back to what we tell parents all the time in early intervention is the best thing you can do is talk to your kid. But
right,
if we're only giving them a screen time for 28, 30 minutes, and there's already an expressive language delay, I would wonder if there's already that delay before the screen time.
Well, I was going to say, especially if it's, you know, if we're talking about a child who's pre-literate, right? So if they're only being exposed to text, then yeah. We have, again, overwhelming evidence that shows that the biggest predictor of language development is comprehensible input and comprehensible output, right? So the more you hear in a language and the more that you produce of a language, the more likely you are to acquire it proficiently. And so if they're, you know, engaged in a screen where they're not having human interaction, then yeah, sure. I could see how that would be the case. This reminds me actually a lot of some of the you know, autism social skill training robots that have come out that I always sort of chuckle at, because that's not authentic social interaction, right? You know, how are you gonna teach someone how to interact with a human if it's, you know, a robot walking around saying hello? So, I'd have to know exactly what the kids were doing. But the message that I guess I would want to convey is that screen time and learning how to use a multi-touch interface is something that's going to serve kids well in the long run, although you should be strategic as a parent and as a clinician about precisely what sort of applications you're exposing the child to.
You know, I'm also curious, what was the control group like? And also, are we accounting for all variables that can affect language development? That's what I would like to really read this study. Perhaps Matt, you can post on the website the article itself or a link to it. That way our listeners could possibly listen to it as well.
Right. I mean, read it. L1, cognitive level, motor ability, visual acuity. There's a lot of stuff there.
And you can find that on speechscience.org.
Yep. I would love to see that on speechscience.org, and I look forward to potentially correcting myself or doubling down on the maybe incorrect things that I'm saying. Listeners and friends, I am being stared at by a big group of audiologists right now who are wondering what I'm doing, so I'm going to have to go for now. But please do enjoy the interview today, and I look forward to speaking to you all next week. All right. That cheers, folks. Have a good evening.
Yeah. See ya. Ivan, what was you going to say about that? Anything else about that article or Chandru?
What I wanted to say is that I work with primary preschoolers in the public school setting, and you know, I get a fair amount of children who parents request a speech and language evaluation, and I am, you know, as I'm going through the parent interview, I don't tend to ask that question a lot about screen time. However, I've noticed now recently with one child I was working with, and the parents were in the room when the evaluation was going on, and one of the parents remarked, you know, I've never seen my son be so interactive with a non-iPad item.
Oh.
And I sat there like, oh, wow, interesting. And it just, the father was basically to the point where, you know, I never knew our son would be interested in anything other than an iPad. And my concern with iPads, and this is just anecdotal experience from raising my own children, my own boys, is that, you know, parents always ask me, so what apps do you think are the best ones to facilitate language development? My response is one-on-one interaction with your child, reading a book, playing an activity, a game. However, if you're going to use an iPad and use an app, that's fine. I would say always balance with connecting the app to the real world and talking to your child about the app and having your child show you things, answer questions about it, but connect it to the world outside of the screen. So that would be my, you know, my comment about this article and from my own experience, anecdotal again, but I'm very curious to read this article in its entirety and see how this study was conducted and see what, you know, what other research says on the topic as well.
And that's the scary part is that I feel that we always have to prove that what we say, what we do has an evidence base to it. And a lot of technology, a lot of the things that are going on, the evidence is not there or the studies have not been done yet.
That's so right. So true.
Anecdotally, very similar to you, Ivan. I have a 4-year-old, and one of the first things that we did when he got old enough to start, you know, with that decision of either screen time or no screen time, was that we looked at action figures, because that really builds that language. He starts to learn to take turns when he has the characters talk to each other. And now there is a wonderful playroom that I'm looking across the hall to that has Star Wars battling the WWE wrestlers as the DC superheroes look on while the Hulk and the Hulkbuster fight. But it's building that rich language environment.
So, Matt, let me ask you a quick question here. So, is that room more for you or your kids?
A little bit of both.
I gather that.
I do have a 3.5 foot long, 2 foot wide Millennium Falcon.
Oh my goodness.
Picked it up at a yard sale for about $18. It was the greatest $20 I've ever spent.
Yeah, I can imagine.
All right, let's look at the second article. This one is coming out of, let me find it. Here we go. This is coming out of Penn State. This hit on May 3rd by Abby Zajid. Speech and language deficits in children with autism may not actually cause tantrums. Her research says speech or language impairments may not be the cause of more frequent tantrums in children with autism. The findings could help parents of children with autism seek out the best treatment for behavior problems. Children with autism experience more tantrums than children without, according to the researchers and speech therapists, preschool teachers, and parents, and others often blame these frequent outbursts on speech and language problems. The children with autism spectrum disorder are not able to speak or have speech, and that is not a clear or well understood by others. To investigate this, the researchers studied the relationship and tantrum frequency between language in 240 children with autism between the ages of 15 and 71 months. So just over, is that 7 years old? 6 years old.
Yeah, six.
Let's see. They published their results in a recent issue of the Journal of Development and Physical Disabilities. IQ is extremely important because a child that has the mental capacity to understand and use language may display different behaviors compared to a child who doesn't have the mental capacity or comprehension to use the language. She also explained the difference between language and speech. Let's see. Tierney suggests enough evidence has accumulated to shift the emphasis from improving speech to improving behavior. We should stop telling parents of children with autism that their child's behavior will get better once they start talking or their language improves, because we now have enough studies to show that this is unlikely to happen without additional support. Thoughts?
The one thing I was kept thinking of is what someone told me. I think I read this online, actually. When you're dealing with a child who has significant behaviors like that, they're not giving you a hard time. They're having a hard time. I feel like that has always helped me really. I think it really helped me interpret the situation and not take it personally, if you will, when students are exhibiting these kind of behaviors.
You know, I recently attended a conference on autism where they had a panel of, I believe, six adults, young adults who were on the spectrum. They were asked questions about, tell us about your schooling experience. You know, what did you like most about school? What did you not like about school? And every one of them responded that they felt school was a waste of time in the terms of adults trying to get them to behave a certain way and act a certain way where their bodies, their brains were not cooperating in what the adults wanted. And they felt that that was a huge waste of their time. They felt that adults sort of just let them alone, give them their own space to work out whatever behavior issues they're having, and then allow them to come back to the group when they were ready. That's very interesting research. I'd like to figure out, how did they measure IQ in this study? Is this an IQ based on nonverbal ability, or is this an IQ based on verbal ability? I mean, there's so many factors in this study that I'm very curious now to find out, you know, what are going to be the ramifications of this study, or perhaps evidence-based practice that we as speech pathologists are going to adopt as a result of this study. Are we going to change the way we structure therapy or structure interactions with students with on the autism spectrum disorder spectrum? Or, you know, or are we going to wait for more studies that perhaps validate this study and then start making a decision as to, do we need to adapt or continue as we're doing with our current models of understanding of what causes these behaviors?
It does not say how they identified IQ, but it does say co-investigator Susan Mays, professor of psychiatry, addressed the limitations in previous research by including a larger sample of children and capturing more measurements. They added that their study is unique because it measures IQ and it separates speech and language as different variables that might affect tantrum behavior in children with autism. It's interesting, though, what you said, though, Ivan, that a lot of times, though, in the school, I think we try to tell families and then we tell other coworkers or other professionals that behavior is almost a sign of communication.
I agree that we do say that.
Yeah, like when a nonverbal student is having a difficulty with saying that they need help or they don't want something or, you know, school's boring, I don't want to be here.
They just don't have the words, yeah. So we need to give them the words so that they're no longer acting out with these behaviors, right?
Right, and I think that this study kind of goes in a way that undermines what we do just a little bit, because you can say that it is behavior, but what causes that behavior? And this study doesn't even say anything about that. They think that it could be mood dysregulation and a low tolerance for frustration. Two common traits are the likely factors that should be studied further, the lead researcher Tierney said. But that really kind of undermines what we try to tell parents and what we try to tell other professionals when we say, if we can get them a voice, we might be able to help get them to state their frustrations.
You know, Matt, it's very interesting that you bring that up. Several years ago, there was an article in the LA Times that discussed a teenager with autism that continues to be nonverbal. However, he writes a blog about his own life and his own experiences. And in that blog, he relates about how many times the reason he's acting out a certain way is unable to control his body, unable to control his mind at times as to the things that he focuses on, or maybe it's too much stimuli from the outside, and so his body reacts, and people are telling him stop, 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 and he's unable. That's what he writes in his article about in his blog. And so, you know, are we giving parents this false hope that if a child, once they have language, that then they'll begin to self-regulate or be able to not become as frustrated once they have those words, once they have that language? Or are we wrong? I guess false hope, or are we wrong, which would be the same thing, I guess. So I'm wondering also this, that at this conference that I recently went to where they had a panel of six adults with autism, young adults, they also discussed the importance of them being alone, that they didn't feel the need to interact with others, that they felt quite comfortable and at peace by themselves. So I'm wondering if we're asking young toddlers, young children, preschoolers, kindergartners to interact with adults, I'm wondering if some of the behaviors we're seeing are more like, I want to be left alone, not more of, I don't have language, but just leave me alone.
And that's a possibility, that as we put stress, as we put expectations on children, that we are pushing them into a realm that maybe they're not comfortable with.
That's very possible.
And then the last article I pulled for is more of a reason that the reason why good evidence-based research and decisions are important. Did you see this? Anti-vaccine activists spark a state's worst measles outbreak in decades.
Was that Minnesota?
Yeah, the largest outbreak in Minnesota.
I'd say 2 years ago it was California, right? All these anti-vaxxers decided to go to Disneyland, basically affected the whole place. Yeah.
That was, what, 2013 or 14, I think, in California.
Yeah, in California.
It was actually somebody visiting from out of state.
Well, as of early April and on Friday, there were 44 cases, all but two occurring in people who are not vaccinated, and all but one in children 10 or younger. Nearly have all been from the Somali American community in Hennepin County. A fourth of the patients have been hospitalized because of the dangerously low vaccination rates and the disease's extreme infectiousness. More cases are expected in the weeks ahead.
I don't know. I mean, firstly, I'm going to use the soapbox that we have. Your speech science been saying vaccinate your kids, you know, or vaccinate yourself too.
I agree.
Autism is not caused by vaccines. That we can almost, with 100% certainty, stand behind.
Yes.
Yeah, the guy's article was retracted, and even if it wasn't retracted, basically it said, five people, we tested five kids, two of them may have had autism and gastrointestinal problems. Therefore, autism leaks through the vaccine into your GI tract and goes to your brain. That was basically what the article was trying to say. I mean, it sounds ridiculous just saying it, but apparently...
Chandra, are you referencing the article?
The Wakefield article.
Okay, yes.
First said that. Oh, yeah. I'll clarify that. This is the Wakefield article that said vaccines, may cause autism. Thoroughly debunked because the sample size was five. And even then, it basically said, we think that when you get injected with thimerosal, it gets it to your GI tract, and then it gets absorbed into your bloodstream and it goes to your brain. Autism. It makes no sense in just saying it, but apparently, that was considered true, but it was of course thoroughly debunked. A meta-analysis of sample size of 1 million found that it was totally wrong. Even just saying it, the way I explained it, sounds totally wrong too. It's one of my
and I can understand why parents want to find out why something happened, and you have a beautiful baby that is developing pretty typically, or at least you think they're developing pretty typically, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere they stop doing things. They don't smile, they don't talk like the other kids that they have, and I can see how parents would latch on to something like that. And you know, the research out there, as you just said, doesn't support it.
Well, you know, they're looking for an answer, and they're also looking for someone or something to be the cause of their child's, you know, autism. You know, Matt, going back to the article in the Minnesota article, did the article go into detail as to the reason why within this population of Somalis, I believe that's the group you mentioned, there was a lack or an interest or a desire to vaccinate? Was it just measles, or was it, you know, a whole set of vaccines? Any reasons as to why? Cultural, religious, or maybe scientific, perhaps?
Back in 2004, the Somali population was vaccinated at a rate of 92%. As compared to the non-Somali vaccination rate of 88%. So about 13 years ago, they were vaccinated at a higher rate.
Is this in Minnesota?
Yes, sir.
Or...
yeah.
Okay.
It's some of it might be because in order to immigrate here, you also need, I think, need to be up to date on vaccinations, as opposed to if you are here already or born here, it is the easier. You know, now it's getting harder, but it's easier to get away without being vaccinated.
So what caused the shift? That's what I'm
curious. Oh, yeah. So it says, let's see. Around the time healthcare providers began receiving reports of parents refusing the MMR vaccine, as parents sought to learn more about the disorder, they came across websites of anti-vaccine groups, and activists from these groups started showing up at community health meetings and distributing pamphlets, recalled Lynn Bata, a longtime state health department nurse who has worked with the Somali nurses to counter the MMR vaccine resistance within the community. At one 2011 gathering featuring Wakefield, Bata recalled an armed guard barred her and other public health officials and reporters from attending.
Wow.
So basically the anti-vaxxers showed up and said, hey, don't do this. Your children could get autism.
And they found a population that would listen to them.
Mm-hmm. So it's basically being... I do know quite a few people, because I hail from the Bay Area, I know quite a few people who are sadly anti-vaxxers up in the Santa Cruz area, and they are Caucasian and many different ethnicities as well. So it's not like it's just right. It's something that a certain ethnic group does. I think sadly it is something that you see in many different ethnic groups. But yeah, it might be interesting seeing too what are the characteristics of a community in which they would reject vaccines. From my anecdotal evidence, it seems like it should be a more smaller community, maybe a bit more insular. And those who seem to have just an inherent mistrust of authorities. Mm-hmm. I think some people just think, oh, this is the government, big pharma, or just doctors, people trying authority just telling me what to do. But I'm going to say no, even though it is in the public and personal good to get vaccinated.
And you know, I've seen this, this trend. It's not even just, I've seen it across people who are professionals and in education settings also, where they have these opinions that about vaccines that they do cause autism. I've encountered that not in publicly, but in private conversations. So,
and by 2014, it said the non-Somali vaccination rate remained the same at about 89%, while the Somali American vaccination rate fell from 92 to 42%.
Wow, that's... And what's the size of the population there in Minneapolis?
Oh, this does not say...
Or Minnesota, sorry.
And is this just Minnesota? Just Minnesota, not a nationwide thing?
Correct, this is just in Minnesota.
A community there.
It does not say. It says just 92 to 42%.
That's a huge drop.
Mm-hmm. And over the last couple of years in the ASHA Leader, they have run articles about the lack of evidence linking autism and vaccination. And of course, here on speechscience.org, we advise you to talk to your doctor and your pediatrician about the correct vaccine schedule for you and your children. Maybe we need to do more to get back into these smaller communities. And actually, that's a good segue into what we're kind of talking about today in the next couple of weeks is how do we bridge into situations or into communities where disabilities are looked down upon or not understood completely. And we start to look at building speech departments around the world. Luke, you were able to sit down and interview who this week?
You know, one thing I've been really lucky about in my career is working with the team in India to create, you know, this app Free Speech, the company Abbas. I've been very fortunate to do a fair amount of traveling. And I did a lot of traveling also as a linguist prior to that. So, you know, I know a fair number of people in Southeast Africa and in the Middle East and, you know, in East Asia and these other places. And so I get messages pretty frequently from students and professionals all around the world. And so this gentleman's name is Aziz, and he sent me a message asking me if I could help him to identify which researchers of these certain papers that he was looking at were L1 English, because his thesis that he's working on is analyzing the academic writing of SLPs and other language professionals who are native English speakers versus those who are not. And it was this bizarre coincidence because he just happened to send a bunch of papers that were written by people that I know. So I knew right away whether they were L1 or not. So we had a correspondence for about a month about this. And then based on some of the things he was saying about his, you know, his life in Iraq and, you know, his academic career, I asked him if we could do a really quick interview. And honestly, I found it to be really moving. And it's a little challenging. So for those of you that are listening, you know, there was a big distance between us. There were some technical issues. But, you know, one of the first things he asked me was whether I could check and see if his friends are okay in the United States. And, you know, it really highlights for me just not only the different ways that that we study and that we, you know, are professionals in this field, but also just the different ways that we're humans, you know, and the way that we experience life. So I was very proud to interview him. I have a huge amount of respect for this individual. I will do anything in my power to assist him in furthering his goals. I think he's brilliant. And this will pair well for an interview that we're going to be doing likely in several weeks. It's actually already been completed, but our schedule's a bit full. We have a lot of podcast guests, which is a good situation to be in, right? But in several weeks, we'll also be able to speak to a young woman named Aisha from Pakistan, which gives an interesting contrast. So I'm excited to have everyone listen. I think especially in the current political climate, it's important to think about, you know, people throughout the world. And I hope you enjoy it.
And that interview will air right after this.
Come on, smile.
Oh, honey, he's still not smiling.
Maybe he's not a smiler.
Yeah, maybe he's just not a happy baby.
Maybe he's just being a boy.
Or maybe he's teething.
Maybe it's just a phase.
Maybe he has autism, and we can definitely do something to help.
Maybe is all you need to find out more about autism. No Big Joyful Smiles by 6 months is one early sign. Learn the others at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Aisha Bhatt from Pakistan. You're listening to the speechscience.org podcast.
Hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm fantastic. How about yourself?
I'm very happy to know you.
Oh, good.
Very kind. You're a very kind person. I'm very happy to know you.
I appreciate you saying that, and I'm thrilled that you asked me for help.
Yes, thank you. I speak slowly because you know that I'm still lucky. And the accent of the Americans, you know, it's very difficult.
I'm sorry.
So, first question, how are our people in America? Are they okay?
Oh, gosh. That's a That's a very interesting question. That's one that I'm not qualified to answer at any real length, unfortunately, at this point. Certainly, the American people as a whole want to ensure the safety and well-being of not only Iraqis, but from any refugees from any war-torn nation. And so far, I think we have done a good job of that. I think there is growing concern about how that might evolve. But certainly myself and others like me will do our best to ensure that your countrymen are safe and happy. Along those same lines, I guess I would ask you, how do you feel? Are you concerned?
Yes, I like all people, in fact, because here we feel that all people are our brothers, or you can't say something like this. And we are, I have so many friends, especially in America, those from Iraq, and I talked to some people who visited America here. They're very kind and they're very nice, and I have always tried to travel to America, but you know, there has been no chance for me to do that. I hope so. And I'm very interesting in English. I'm very really interesting in English, and I like those who speak this language, because apart from my being Arabic, I feel that speaking another language or acquiring another language is to something to get or to know the educations of other people and to know the civilizations of others. There is no problem if our language are different, but our feelings are one.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
If our languages are different, if our religions are different, by humanity and the feel of love and the feel on the fact that even if we are different from one another in languages or in religion, we are unified by humanity.
That's a wonderful sentiment, and I'm so glad that you brought it up. I want to extend on behalf of myself and of our team that I appreciate what you're saying, and I greatly admire your interest in not only world languages, but in our language. There is a very famous theory from the 1950s called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Are you familiar with this?
Sapir-Whorf relevance theory. Yes. You mean the theory, the linguistic theory by Sapir-Whorf?
Yes.
Yes. That language determines thought.
Precisely correct. And that people that speak two different languages might actually see the world in different ways. And I have heard this argument made comparing English speakers versus, you know, speakers of Arabic, and you're somebody that sort of bridges that divide. How do you feel about that? Because that's not what you just said.
Yes, I feel that according to antithesis theory, that for those people who are educated linguistically, their thinking is different from common people, and their it's modernized, and it is really that I have experienced this theory by Sapir-Whorf, relative or determinative theory, that language determines the way we think, that language determines the way we look at the world, for it differently from those who are, their languages are poor. Am I correct? Sorry, because I cannot always say what I feel. I cannot always express my knowledge or my, because you know that I'm not a native speaker of English.
No, this is actually, what you said that your English was not very strong, I would argue the opposite. I think you're doing quite well. You're speaking quickly and very articulately. Okay, well that's...
I'm a teacher, don't forget. I'm a teacher of English for 11 years, or I've been teaching English for students of intermediate schools, and then I have joined the college, and I was, linguistics, really. I'm interested in linguistics, especially in discourse analysis, and completed my study. And yes, if you have any specific questions, I'm ready to answer.
Yeah, well, I was curious, and you did broke up very briefly there, but so is this the Ibn Sabil University, or where are you teaching now?
No, yes, I'm in Iraq first, okay? My name is Aziz Khalaf Saleh. I was born in 1978.
So you've been through a number of different changes then in the country in which you live.
I studied the department. I said proper. I graduated from 2001.
Okay. And you said that you started the department?
Yes, I like language very much. And I'm interested in first the literature and have read a lot of stories and novels by different authors. So I have been teaching English more till the 2005. I've been teaching English till the time, till the period of 2015. Then moved to Babylon University. Babylon University to complete my study in linguistics. I have finished the first year last year. Then I have chosen a thesis genre analysis of English academic writings by native and non-native speakers. My research title, don't forget, genre analysis.
I just want to briefly address our listeners here. Obviously, we are several thousand miles away from each other, and I think that we have a little bit of a delay. So I feel poorly, Aziz, because I don't want to keep interrupting you, but things come to mind, and I don't realize that your feed is not finished yet. So I'm sorry about that. As a student now, what you are doing is you are studying academic writing by native English speakers, as opposed to those maybe who were not born.
My project is that I must collect a data of theses or articles which are written by native and non-native speakers. Data which are written by non-native linguistics in general. Yes, linguistics in general. But till now, I have not decided to what scope I'm going to limit my work. Am I going to analyze the abstracts or articles or ATC, article theses or the discussion section or conclusion section? So my supervisor tell me that if I finish the literature review on my thesis, we shall decide together, by native and non-native speakers, or the articles written by native and non-native speakers. The problem is that. The problem is not with the non-native speakers of English, because they are Iraqis, you know that. They are graduates from Iraqi universities, for example, Baghdad University or Boston University or Babylon. The problem is with the native speakers. Since in America it is difficult to recognize who are native and who are non-native speakers, and if I asked for your help.
Yes, which is how we first met. You had asked me to go through a number of papers, you know, and determine by essentially looking up, you know, who was native and non-native. And in this ironic twist, I happen to know quite a number of the authors that you sent me, which made this an easier job than it would have been otherwise. One of those authors was Dr. Susan Conrad, who is someone who was on my thesis committee for linguistics many years ago before I became a speech pathologist. And then, of course, I sent you one of my own papers that looked at something like that. And I imagine that you're familiar with this, but I think there's probably a great deal of computational analysis that you could apply to the corpus of papers that you're acquiring that would give you some very interesting information.
Yes, I know that, but some doctors in Iraq here told me that the 10 native speakers have been recently an elusive 10, in the sense that even those who are non-native speakers any further, and they are, for example, raised and get acquainted with the American English, for example, they are so far are considered as native speakers because mastered this language. And therefore, for example, you see that some articles written in Portland University, they are co-authored by those who are native and non-native speakers.
And part of that, I think, is a function that Portland is rather known in the United States as being a place where many foreigners come to study. You may not find that everywhere in the U.S., but it was surprising to me also to find that almost every other author was not a native English speaker.
Yes, but how can this make image that even those Marines seem to be because they all, most of their time, staying in America. You know, the media now, all people, even outside America or outside the United Kingdom, they can get acquainted with the American or British accent without being living in America itself.
Interesting. Okay. And how do you think that happens? Is this through exposure to television?
Yes, of course.
Yes, okay.
I'm always in contact with the program. So I talked to American, by the way, I talked to some Americans here who have settled in Iraq, and I felt something about English. That's 11 years I'm reading this language. I'm interested, really. But you know that here, the technology is, and the ambitions here in Iraq are limited.
That's interesting.
America, complete your Okay. I really appreciate your help, and I thank you very much. If you need anything so far from me to help you in your project, I'm ready.
Yes, absolutely. I appreciate your time. I'm happy to keep speaking if you wish. Although maybe you have, I think I heard a child in the background. at one time.
So you teach primary schools, primary pupils, their native language is Arabic?
We do have a few, yes. And in fact, I will. I don't know if you have access to an iPad or iPhone, maybe. But I can send you a copy of some of the tools that we've built. I certainly do have speakers of Arabic, of Amharic, of other languages from that region that I work with. However, as a clinician, I work exclusively with children that do not speak verbally. They use augmentative communication devices, right, to produce speech, which is particularly challenging because in the United States, it's already hard enough to determine what a child would like to say in English, let alone, you know, a child that has just immigrated here, for example, from Syria. You know, I don't know what they want to say. So, as we're starting this website, Speech Science, this was great timing that you contacted me because this is a question that I'm asked very often. And every time I go to a conference, for example, I have people from Qatar and other places come and ask me what I'm working on, and I never have a good answer. It's very reassuring to have you contact me.
Don't you ask for those who speak two languages, Arabic, English, or their origins, or from Iraq, for example? I have some people who traveled from Iraq who are bilingual. I mean, speak Iraqi and English.
Part of the problem, and perhaps you can correct me on this perception that we've been given, there is a great deal of variability within Arabic dialects, not only in terms of the actual, you know, oral language, but also in terms of the orthography, the writing. I don't know enough to know whether that's true. Perhaps you could tell me that that's false, but that's one hurdle that we've encountered.
I speak two languages only, to be clear. I speak Arabic and English. So if you want me to help you containing Arabic, I'm ready to help you.
Yeah, that is an incredible offer, and it's one that I assure you that we will take you up on. We will contact you about that. So I guess I had one final question for you. The question I like to ask sometimes is, what would you like to tell me that I didn't ask you about?
I guess that when I told my supervisor that I contact you, I tried to convince him that it's enough to be a clarification that they are native speakers, but he told me that I should contact them one by one. I mean, the scholars, the authors of that article. I told him that it is difficult, and not all the scholars are ready to contact me.
Yeah, sometimes they are hard to reach. Also, yes.
I think I have sent to I cannot remember, but only Keith Walters have replied me, and Brittana Wildney, I think, and you contact me. Others so far do not have been contacted me. If I get your help to tell some of them, only five at least, or three, to contact with me directly, I would appreciate your help.
Yeah, well, and please continue to count on me for anything, and I still am curious as to how you found me specifically, but we can also write about that. I'm just curious.
I have sent to Portland University itself, and Summer Librarian, helped me and wrote some authors that they are native speakers. My supervisor insisted on contacting the authors. So I told them that it's impossible to do with the authors. He told me that there are just only 10 authors and you can contact them easily.
Yeah, that's often not the case.
I have contacted 3. I need only 7. I need only 5 authors of them to contact them and ask them just like you and told me that they are native.
Yeah, well, and potentially having one or two people look over and make sure that we're accurate, but this happened to be particularly, this worked out well because I knew, you know, so many of the people that it was very easy. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time. This has been an incredible opportunity. I'm speaking on behalf of speechscience.org and my colleagues here. I appreciate you taking the time to do this, and I further appreciate the perspective that you've shared that we will now be able to share with speech therapists and linguists in the United States. So know that we support you, and please reach out as much as you need. So.
Yeah, thank you very much, really.
People are always looking to invest in a good opportunity. So what if you could invest in the future of kids, like a stock? Not the kind of stock that's about making money, but a stock for social change called Better Futures. With your investment, it helps students like me go to college. My name is Charles, and I'm your dividend.
Invest in better futures with UNCF. Visit uncf.org/invest. A mind is a terrible thing to waste, but a wonderful thing to invest in. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the SpeechScience.org podcast. I'm Matt Hott alongside Ivan Campos and Chandru Vittal. Lucas Stuber had to step away to finish up his audiology art gallery, but a pretty interesting interview talking about a little bit about communication, a little bit about the differences from around the globe. And we have to do this when we do therapy. We have to always consider the dialectical difference versus a disorder.
Most definitely. And also be able to understand another person's culture in order to build that level of trust upon which all therapy, all interactions, I believe, are built upon in order for them to be most successful.
Yeah, I agree. Personally, I'm glad that when I was receiving speech services, it was only corrected what was a disorder and not what was the difference. I was able to keep what I feel is part of my cultural heritage, as opposed to just becoming fully assimilated, fully mainstreamed. So I think that was a blessing, and I think that's something that I aspire to really keep in mind as I am in my career.
And that's kind of why at the beginning of every episode you'll hear that music and you hear a bunch of random people. Us, there's a couple radio guys in there talking about what communication is. A couple researchers talk about what communication is. And that's the important thing, is that we have to remember that the communication of your patient is different than what the communication that we come in with, that biasness. Well, then looking ahead, we've got a few podcasts lined up. Ivan, what's coming up on the horizon for us?
So I have a few podcasts that I'm working on. The first one is with Dr. Maria Munoz from University of Redlands, who specializes in bilingual aphasia therapy diagnosis. And also she's a director of SIG-14 for ASHA. And so I'm looking forward to that interview, as well as I have another very unique interview with Dr. Keith Wolgamuth, who is professor at Loma Linda University. He's an audiologist, and he's in charge of the SLPD program for speech-language pathologists.
Very nice. And Chandru, you had an opportunity to sit down with Ivan and Lucas and interview a Pakistani speech and language pathologist?
That's correct. We interviewed Dr. Aisha Bhatt. She was trained actually in the United Kingdom, but realized that she saw a need to return to Pakistan and work with the underserved populations there. She saw that there was a lack of licensing, a lack of standardized training. Basically, there anyone could just go up and say, "Oh, I am a speech-language pathologist. I will treat your kid." And she did notice a lot of really interesting things there. A lot of needs there. She noticed there's a lot of exploitation, and she was talking a lot about the various challenges of being a speech pathologist in a more developing nation. For example, there are more language barriers. There's more issues with financial issues too. People take advantage of them. There's also, as I said before, apparently you could also, for a relatively low cost, you could actually buy HSCs. And she actually went after some of these companies, some of these agencies, that said you cannot do this. You don't even know what C's stand for. And she got that done. And she was talking about how it is and the challenges of building a graduate program as well, with the relative lack of resources that are found in a developing nation. For example, many AAC devices just simply aren't available and are out of reach, even if you could afford them, shipping them from wherever they're manufactured is basically impossible. So I found it a really fascinating talk, also interesting talking about the different cultural linguistic differences in Pakistan. I found it was really interesting comparing how it is based on mainstream American culture, which is what I've interacted in for most of my life.
Very good. And then I had an opportunity to sit down with a deaf journalist who moonlights as a roller derby defender. And I will be sitting down with a person from Ohio who goes out to Botswana to help build their speech and language program out there. When this hits live, there'll also be a new article up on speechscience.org. The part three of my look at a couple of different apps for data collection in the schools. Ivan, Chandru, do you guys have any new articles hitting this week on speechscience.org?
Yes, we actually got a new interesting article submitted to us about noise-canceling headphones and the differences between them and the implications of knowing what the different marketing terms are and how they will affect your practice. So that'll be up there. I will also be putting up my summary of the Tao Bunuswati article and the transcript of it as well too. I know, people are, it's easier to send if it's in written form, and sometimes you might not really get and watch the interview.
And I'm looking forward to an article by a guest blogger on transgender voice therapy and issues that individuals who identify as transgender experience. And so that should be coming up in the next couple of weeks here as well.
Great. Well, gentlemen, we are 4 episodes away from becoming a habit. They say you have to do something 7 times to become a habit, and this is the end of episode number 3. So
become addicted.
4 more away from becoming a habit.
Yeah, just become addicted. There's no withdrawal symptoms. Actually, there are, but that's why we come out every week.
And if you want to subscribe, thank you for that, Chandru. If you want to subscribe, head on over to iTunes and click the subscribe button. Also, rate us 5 stars. Write a little note underneath of there. Let us know what you think of the podcast. The more 5 stars we get, the more listeners we can subscribe to. Also, you can check us out on Google Play. You can head on over to speechscience.org. You can get the links for both of those. If you want to get in contact with the 4 of us, give us a phone call. Leave us a voicemail at 503-345-6740. Again, area code 503-345-6740. If you prefer to write down what you want to say, you can email us at contact@speechscience.org. Hit us up on the Twitters at speech_science or Ivan Campos. Lay down that Instagram handle for me.
Again, at speech_science, and we're also found on Facebook under Speech Science.
So anywhere you are, we will be there for you. For Ivan Campos, Lucas Stuber, Chandru Vital, I'm Matthew Hott for speechscience.org podcast. Our introductory music tonight was Please Listen Carefully by Jazar. It's licensed under the Attribution and Share Alike license. Our closing music tonight is Pinnacle by Fleslet, is licensed under an Attribution Only license. Ladies and gentlemen, find someone that you don't agree with and find common ground. So long, everybody.